Hi, you're listening to Modern Tech News on KZSU Stanford 90.1 FM. Thank you so much for joining us today for a show about how simple technologies can help change the world. Today, our guest is Dr. Martin Fisher, CEO and co-founder of Kickstart International. Kickstart is important because they have helped lift approximately 750,000 people out of poverty in Africa. That's a great achievement. In today's show, Dr. Martin Fisher will describe some of the technologies that he developed that helped accomplish this goal. He will also discuss Kickstart's philosophy and program that helped the poor in Africa get out of poverty forever. Dr. Martin Fisher received his PhD in mechanical engineering from Stanford University, and then he decided to become a social entrepreneur. In today's show, he will share with us why he decided to become a social entrepreneur and why he decided to go to Africa and help lift the poor out of poverty. Dr. Martin Fisher is not only an expert in technology, he's also an expert in Africa, where he has lived for more than 18 years. He will describe how he started Kickstart and why he decided to specialize in irrigation technology and target those simple technologies to improve the crops of sub-Saharan African farmers. Success did not happen overnight for Kickstart. They have been working very hard since they started in 1991, and today they have a lot to celebrate. They can celebrate their success in helping 750,000 people get out of poverty. They can celebrate the success of their handheld pumps that help the farmers in sub-Saharan Africa. They can also celebrate that Kickstart's pumps are quite important because in Kenya alone, the users of Kickstart's pumps are generating new revenues that are equivalent to 0.6% of all of Kenya's GDP. At the end of today's interview, our guest, Dr. Martin Fisher, will give us some examples of how farmers in Africa use the Kickstart pumps to irrigate more land, generate more revenue, and thereby get out of poverty. Dr. Martin Fisher has received many awards, including Time Magazine's 2003 European Hero Award, the Schwab Foundation's 2003 Social Entrepreneur of the Year Award, the Tech Award for Economic Development, the Lemelson MIT Award for Sustainability, as well as the Engineer of the Year from Design News Magazine and the Peter Drucker Award for Nonprofit Innovation. My first question was, what did Dr. Martin Fisher study at Stanford University, and what helped him decide to develop technologies that would help the poor?
I did a PhD in mechanical engineering. I come from a family where you almost need a PhD in physics to qualify for the family. So I actually did my PhD in theoretical and applied mechanics in a physics lab, applied physics lab. And it was really halfway through my PhD that I realized the more education I had, the less I was qualified to do in many ways, in that I could either get a job trying to teach, or I could do military research, or I could do research for big oil. And none of that excited me very much. And that's when I went down to Peru and spent the summer down there trekking in the mountains and seeing poverty for the first time and starting to think, well, maybe I could do something with technology and poverty. So I came back from Peru, and I decided, well, maybe I can take a break for a year and go and look at the issue of technology and poverty in developing countries and see if there's anything I could do with my PhD from Stanford, with the idea that I'd go for a year and then come back and most likely go and try to teach somewhere. And I got back and I applied for two different opportunities. The first one was a Fulbright Fellowship to go back to Peru, and the second was actually volunteers in Asia. It's a Stanford program, and at that time, it had a program on appropriate technology sending people to Indonesia and the Philippines. My preference was the Fulbright because it was a bit more academic, and since I was planning to come back to academics, I thought that was the right thing. And literally 2 days before the applications were due for the Fulbright, I had an interview with some of the people there, and they told me, you don't speak Spanish. You're not going to Peru. You're not going to get this Fulbright. And so I flipped through the blog and information on Fulbright and saw that they also had Fulbright possibilities in Kenya, and I thought, ah, well, they speak English in Kenya. Maybe I can apply to go to Kenya instead. And so I made a few phone calls, and of course, this was 1985. This was long before we had the internet, easy access, our cell phones. But I managed to, in a couple of days, make some contacts in Kenya and wrote an application for a Fulbright to go to Kenya. And I got lucky enough to get that Fulbright, and I went down to Kenya for 10 months and ended up staying for almost 18 years.
My next question was, what did Dr. Martin Fisher hope to accomplish when he arrived in Kenya, and what did he actually end up accomplishing?
What I was hoping to do when I went was to get involved in what they called at that time the appropriate technology movement. And in the mid-70s, a man called E.F. Schumacher, an economist, had written a quite famous book called Small is Beautiful, where he had been advocating for low-cost, small-scale technologies as really the solution for poor people in developing countries. After he wrote that book, there was a whole movement that took off, and literally hundreds of millions of dollars were spent across the world promoting small-scale technologies for the poor. And so I thought I would, in 1985, slot nicely right into that movement in Kenya, and there was quite a bit that had happened in Kenya. But I got there, and they told me, oh, no, no, we've moved beyond that. We tried that technology for the poor stuff, and that didn't work. Now we've moved on to the next big thing. And this happens very, very often in development circles, where they spend a lot of money for a number of years on one latest idea, and then they sort of throw the baby out with the bathwater and decide, well, the whole thing didn't work, let's move on to the next big thing. And I was like, I don't know, I'm just an engineer, but it seems to me like there might be something that technology could do to help alleviate poverty. And I looked around and I found a small group at an organization called ActionAid, which is a British nonprofit similar to Save the Children. They have child sponsorship. There was a small group there who was still doing a bit with technology, and in particular, they were building low-cost primary schools and training local artisans how to do that. And it was there that I met Nick Moon, who was an ex-carpenter and a VSO, a British volunteer overseas, and he'd ended up at ActionAid in this program building low-cost primary schools. And I joined up with him and ended up volunteering for ActionAid, both through my Fulbright year and then for another year afterwards, and then ended up working with ActionAid for about 5.5-6 years. And at ActionAid, I did a lot of very, very typical development activities. At that time, the newest craze was something called integrated rural development, where you would go into a community in the rural areas and you would spend a large amount of money in that particular community over a 5 to 10 year period, with the hope that you would sort of bring that community out of poverty. And that phase went on for quite some time and, of course, was recently reinvented by Jeffrey Sachs with the Millennium Villages. But like I say, very often there's not many lessons learned when we throw one new sort of methodology for development out and give it up and then come back to it 20, 30 years later. But anyway, so what I did is I looked around and said, well, we're helping these communities, and these communities clearly need clean water because we all know clean water is vital for development. And so I established what became one of the largest clean water programs in Kenya at the time. And we were going into communities, we were helping them to dig wells, we were providing them with nice water pumps, community-owned water pumps that we would put on top of the well, and we would have nice clean water. I also established a couple of rural workshops where we mass-produced farm equipment, in particular ox-drawn plows and harrows and ox carts and donkey carts, which we would then give away to local farmers. And I designed a few machines for making low-cost building materials, and we would set women's groups and youth groups up in these businesses manufacturing these low-cost building materials. And all of these things are very, very typical for development, and they all sound good when you hear about them, and even when you go visit them, they look good. And we think they're having a lot of impacts. But the truth is, because of my more scientific background and training, I always wanted to look at these things a little bit more analytically and a little bit more scientifically and ask, are we really having an impact, and is it really a sustainable and lasting impact? And unfortunately, all too often, the answer to that question was no. So we would go and install these wells in the villages. We would, of course, involve the community and develop a well water committee in the community to look after that pump. You know, the community would have been involved in bringing materials and helping us to decide where to put the pump. And as long as the pump worked, everything was good and everybody was happy and they had nice clean water. But 4 or 5 years later, when the pumps broke down and needed some maintenance or repair, by that time, of course, the water committee had done nothing and was completely disbanded because it hadn't been busy for the last 4 or 5 years. And the only thing they remembered is, oh yes, that agency ActionAid came along and donated this water pump to us. And so nobody would fix the pump. And of course, it was a bit of the tragedy of the commons. Why should I fix it if you're going to use it? Why should you fix it if I'm going to use it? And as a result, nobody fixed it. And then somebody would steal the handle, sell her the scrap, and it would become one of the almost 100,000 broken down community water points that now are scattered across Africa, because we continue to put them in and they continue to break down after 4 or 5 years and not be maintained. Then we come along and put in new ones.
So how did international aid fare otherwise in Africa if the pumps that they gave away ended up broken down after 5 years or so? Did giving away farm equipment help the African farmers?
In terms of giving away farm equipment, it sounds like a nice idea, but the farmers we gave it to didn't really appreciate it very much. In particular, it wasn't necessarily what they wanted. But much more seriously than that, there was a business down the road trying to sell farm equipment and that they were making. And of course, we put them out of business because we were giving it away. And then 4 or 5 years later, when the funding ran out for our donor-funded project, there was no farm equipment in the community. So actually, you can do more damage than good. Youth groups and women's groups getting started up in businesses, well, they're not very sustainable. It's very hard to run a business as a group, and especially when that group is put together in order to get a donor handout. And so the minute we let go of their hand, they would fall apart. And again, there was an entrepreneur down the road who wanted to start the business, and we wouldn't help that entrepreneur. And we would make it hard for that entrepreneur to compete with this handheld business. Anyway, so we learned a lot of lessons over those years about what didn't work and some lessons about what could work better. And it was with those lessons that we decided to leave ActionAid. In fact, Nick Moon and I, who had then become very good friends, were asked to leave ActionAid because we continued to say that, you know, so much of these things weren't working well and that they should be doing things differently. And of course, they didn't like to hear that.
Our guest is Dr. Martin Fisher, co-founder and CEO of Kickstart, a nonprofit organization that works in Africa and specializes in irrigation technologies. Next, Dr. Martin Fisher will describe the lessons that he learned while working at ActionAid in Africa and how those lessons helped him shape the philosophy and mission of Kickstart.
The lessons we learned, of course, were many, but some of them were that community ownership is very, very difficult, and in fact, we should always have individual family or individual ownership. It works much, much better. We shouldn't give things away. It's not sustainable. It turns out to be expensive. It's unfair. How do you decide who to give it to? You have to set up a whole distribution network, so that's not cheap either. And of course, it demotivates people, and it also hurts the private sector when we give things away. Now, there are cases when you're trying to solve, a crisis after a tragedy of some kind, or natural disaster, or refugee crisis, where you have to do giveaways. And also in public health, there's some arguments for giveaways, but generally, giveaways are not a good thing to do. And we also learned that nothing is taken to scale. So many development programs happen on a small pilot basis, and they might be very good and have good impacts, but they're not designed so they can be scaled up. And so you have these little islands of success. But maybe the biggest lesson we learned is, you know, and it's obvious in retrospect, is that when you're poor, everybody everywhere in the world still lives in a cash economy. And however poor they are, they still need money, and they need money to buy the basics. They need money to buy food. Even if they can grow maize, they can't grow cooking oil and sugar and tea and salt. They still need money for that. They need money for cooking pots. They need money for clothes. They need money to build a house. They need money to pay for education, to pay for health care. They need money for transportation. They need money for fuel. They need money if they want clean water. And so actually they live in a cash economy, and when it comes down to it, the number one need of a poor person anywhere in the world is the need to be able to make a lot more money. And if they can make a lot more money, of course, they are no longer poor, and they can afford all the things that we believe and know are so vital for them to what we consider get out of poverty. And what you discover is that everybody in Africa, in fact, is making a little bit of money. If they weren't making a little bit of money, they wouldn't be alive for very long. They're just not making enough money to get out of poverty. So why is this? If they're farmers, and it turns out that 80% of the poor in Africa are poor rural farmers, they grow their crops, and they need the money more than they need the food. So what they do is they turn around and they immediately sell the crop in order to get a bit of money so they can pay for school fees and buy clothes and all the other things they need the money for. And of course, since they all sell their crop at the same time, they get very little money because the price is very low. And so they need more money, so they send a family member to the city because there's more money in the city than there is in the rural area. And they start small businesses. And generally, they'll do things like petty trade. And something like 60-70% of all small businesses are petty trade. They're sitting on the side of the road buying and selling the same type of products to the same customers. Very competitive. They make a little bit of money, but the margins are small, of course. Or they get into, metalwork, carpentry, tailoring, food preparation, or two or three other businesses. And, 9 or 10 businesses, and that's 99% of all the ways that poor people make money. All competing with each other, all very competitive, very low margins, making enough money to survive, but not enough to get out of poverty. And so we looked at that and we said, well, what's the fundamental problem? And the fundamental problem is that they're all in the wrong business. And why is that? Well, it's very difficult when you're poor, you're uneducated, you're underexposed. It's very difficult to come up with a new business idea. And even if you do come up with a new business idea, you can't access the tools and equipment you need to make that business viable. So tools that are affordable to buy, affordable to use, and profitable to use are simply not available, and certainly not available in the local marketplace where these people live in Africa. So we said, wow, if we can solve those two problems, if we can identify businesses that millions of people can start with a very small investment and that would be very profitable, if we can identify what those businesses are, and then we can design the tools and equipment they need to start those businesses, then they've already proven that they can start businesses, they're just starting the wrong ones, so we can sell them this equipment, and they can buy it and start very profitable small businesses. And instead of making a little bit of money, they can now run their businesses and make a lot more money. So we left ActionAid and we established an organization we called AfroTech, Appropriate Technologies for Enterprise Creation, which we later changed the name to Kickstart, with a mission to enable millions of very poor families to make a lot more money and as a result get out of poverty. And we do this precisely by identifying businesses they could start and then designing the tools and equipment they need for those businesses and then mass marketing them and telling them that, hey, you can buy these technologies and you can start a business. We did that in 1991 is when we left and started AfroTech, which became Kickstart.
My next question was, how easy was it to start a social enterprise and a nonprofit organization that works with the poor in Africa?
It's, of course, tough to start a social enterprise because you begin with no money, and it was just me and Nick. And we were lucky we got a matching grant from the British government, which is great, but if there's nothing to match it with, of course, you don't get any money. So for the first year or two, we matched it by volunteering, and so we didn't get paid. And we could take our salary and use that match of our salary now to hire some other people. And then there was a refugee crisis in East Africa with about 500,000 refugees pouring over the border from Somalia into northern Kenya. This was the first Somali refugee crisis. And we got involved there building toilets for the refugee camps. It's a long story, but it turned out that the Somali refugees wouldn't use communal toilets, and it was the first time in the history of refugee camps this had happened. And we had developed a very low-cost individual family toilet, and we ended up getting a contract to install about 45,000 of these toilets in refugee camps and then trained all the other agencies and installed over 100,000. So every refugee had their own personal toilet, each family. And this was a large contract, and we managed to use the overhead on that contract to match the grant we got from the British so we could actually run Kickstart and develop technologies to lift people out of poverty. So that's really how we got started.
You're listening to Modern Tech News on KZSU Stanford 90.1 FM. Our guest today is Dr. Martin Fisher, CEO and co-founder of Kickstart. Next, Dr. Martin Fisher will describe the technologies that are manufactured by Kickstart and how they help the farmers in Africa. If you would like additional information about Kickstart, please visit their website, kickstart.org.
From there, we started with a number of different technologies. They were for manufacturing low-cost building materials with our first technology, because if you're starting a business and you're poor, who are your customers going to be? It's very hard as a poor person to start a business selling to very wealthy people because you don't know your customers. You don't know wealthy people. Of course, it's very hard to start an export business because you certainly don't know people outside of your country. But the people you do know are your neighbors, who are poor people, like you. And you know them well. So any business should really start by selling to your neighbors. And that means you're selling to other poor people, and we know what other poor people buy, because we've just made a list of all the things they spend their money on. And that is, of course, food, farm input, clothing, shelter, communication, transport. And the list is not very long, a few other things on it. And that's then a list of all the businesses you could start. And so we started with the building materials, so a machine for making low-cost building blocks from soil and cement, a machine for making roofing tiles from sand and cement. And we designed machines that could do that, and we sold them to entrepreneurs who bought the machines and started actually thousands of businesses using those machines. And then we designed a machine for making cooking oil from sunflower seed, because certainly cooking oil is something that a poor person pays for. And it turns out that a poor person generally pays the highest price per unit in the world for everything they buy. And they usually buy poor quality products. And so for cooking oil, a very poor person will buy cooking oil by the teaspoon, because that's all they can afford. And so they pay a very high price per unit for that teaspoon of cooking oil. And so it turns out that manufacturing cooking oil from sunflower seed locally in the rural area is actually a very good business. And we had a machine that could take sunflower seed and produce cooking oil and produce animal feed as a byproduct. And we designed that and mass marketed that and sold a few thousand of those machines to entrepreneurs. And then we asked ourselves, what business could your average poor African start? And your average poor African, in fact, 80% of the poor in Africa, are smallholder farmers. They live in the rural area, they live on a small plot of land, and they survive by growing basic food crops and selling what they can to make money and then eating the rest. And so if we're going to tackle poverty, that's where 80% of the poverty is, we have to find ways to enable these very poor farmers to make a lot more money. And it turns out the best thing that they can do is move away from rain-fed agriculture, where they all plant the same crop at the same time when it rains, and they all harvest at the same time, 3 or 6 months later, and of course all sell the same crop into the same market, and there's very few middlemen. They can't sell to their neighbors because their neighbors also have the crop. So they sell to the middlemen, they get very low prices, and in fact they don't sell all of it, and all the evidence shows that somewhere between 15 and 50% of the crop that they grow is spoiled and goes bad before they can eat it or sell it. So they're making very little money from this rain-fed agriculture. They move away from that and do irrigated agriculture. Because suddenly with irrigation, you're no longer dependent on the rain. You can bring out crops throughout the year. You can bring out high-value crops and get high yields because you have enough water. But most importantly, you bring out these crops in the long dry season when nobody else has any crops. And the price goes up by a factor of 10 or a factor of 20, especially for perishable crops in the dry season. And so you can make a huge amount of money if you can grow crops with irrigation. And there's very little irrigation in Africa. Less than 4% of the farmland in sub-Saharan Africa is irrigated. If you compare that to Asia, it's about 42% in Asia. So there's absolutely huge potential. There's a lot of water resources that are not used in Africa. But there was really no technology. A petrol pump was a little bit expensive, certainly, and also it's hard to get the petrol, the gas, in the rural areas when you're miles off the road and the closest gas station is a long way away. And, of course, it's expensive to pay for the gas every time you have to go fuel up your pump. And then if your pump does break down, it's hard to maintain, hard to repair, and you're going to lose your crop. And solar pumps, which might be another option, solar electric pumps, it's still fairly expensive to buy solar electricity. Of course, it has got cheaper in the last couple of years. And to replace a human power with solar power would be about, a human is about 80 watts of power continuous that you're putting out. So it was quite a few dollars, if you talk about $4 or $5 per watt to replace that 80 watts of human power. So solar was too expensive, and of course there's no electricity in the rural area. So we really had to design human-powered pumps, as our other machines have been also. Our oil press and our block press were also human-powered, because that is the power source which is most available. There's a lot of underemployed people with a lot of energy. So we designed a line of human-powered irrigation pumps that we call money-maker pumps, because a poor person's number one need is a way to make more money. And we have a little Stairmaster pump, which can pull water from as deep as 30 feet from a shallow well or from a surface water, from a spring or from a lake or a river. And it can push that water through a hose pipe under pressure onto your garden, just like a garden hose. And with a little Stairmaster pump, which weighs just about 20 kilos, so about 45, 50 pounds, which is portable, You can now irrigate up to 2 acres of land if you work for a couple hours in the morning, a couple hours in the evening. And it's just like a garden hose with pressurized irrigation, so you can take the water directly to where the plants are, directly to the roots of the plant, or you can spray it on the plants. And so that's our super moneymaker pump. And then we also have designed a lower cost pump, something called the moneymaker hip pump, which looks like an oversized bicycle pump, but it's actually operated in a similar way to a bicycle pump, except that it's got a base and it's got a pivot on the end of that base. And so it's actually, you hold the handle, and instead of pulling up and down with your arms, you get into a rocking motion where you're actually using your whole body motion in order to pump. And this is something you can do for much longer than you could if it was simply a bicycle pump. So a simple change to the ergonomics made a big difference. And that pump, if you irrigate, again, 4 or 5 hours a day, you can irrigate 1.25 acres. And again, it can pull water from as deep as 30 feet and push it through a hose pipe, another 30-foot pressure head, and you can have a sprinkler, or you can spray by hand, or take the water directly to the roots of the plant. So that's called the Moneymaker Hip Pump. Those are the pumps that we've sold now. We've sold 210,000 of those pumps. We're selling about 28,000 pumps per year. And when a farmer starts to irrigate, on average, they're increasing their net annual profit by $700 per year. And so these are families who very often have been living on less than $600 or $700 per year for the whole family per year. And now all of a sudden, on average, they're making another $700 profit per year, so doubling their total annual income, increasing their farm income by a factor of as much as 10, because their farm income has only been a small portion of their previous income. And this absolutely transforms their lives.
Before listening to examples about African farmers whose lives were transformed by these irrigation pumps, I asked Dr. Martin Fisher to describe to us the logic and rationale that went into the design of these irrigation pumps.
And we designed them very carefully so that they're very durable, they're very efficient, ergonomically efficient, very hydrodynamically efficient, so they pump a lot of water for the amount of effort you put in. And a farmer doesn't own a screwdriver, a farmer doesn't own a hammer, so you have to make this pump so it can be maintained and installed simply with two hands. You can take the pump apart, it's got very few spare parts, and they can all be just changed with two hands, with no tools at all. And they have to be extremely strong and durable, because these pumps are going to be in remote areas, and if they break down, that would be a problem, so you have to design them so they really don't break down, even if maybe a couple of people jump on them in order to try to pump more water. And then we have to distribute these pumps. So we have them mass-produced. We used to do that in Africa. Now we actually have them mass-produced in China, because it is cheaper to do it there. And then we sell them through a network of about 400 local retail shops. And these retail shops are now scattered around the countries where we work, and they otherwise sell seeds and fertilizer and pesticides and other farm inputs, and now they also sell an irrigation pump, which is very often the biggest ticket item they've ever sold. So we now have a distribution network closer to where the farmers live. But it turns out those are the easy parts, designing the right technology and getting it close to the farmers in a distribution network. Those are the easy parts. The hard part is convincing a very poor farmer who has never irrigated, not only in their own lives, but in the whole history of their family's lives. And you're trying to convince them now to change the way they farm, to do something completely different and completely change their behavior. And not only that, but to buy an expensive item, a $35 hip pump or a $100 super moneymaker pump and some hose pipes, and so make a major investment in order to completely transform their lives. And it's very hard to convince people to change their behaviors, and especially people who live in very remote areas and are very risk-averse, because if they spend money and they don't get an improvement in their lives, they're going to be very hungry, and very poor people who have no savings and no credit. And so that's what we spend our time and effort doing, which is really educating farmers about irrigation, about why irrigation can change their lives, and how these particular pumps can enable them to irrigate, and how they can make a lot more money, and what will that mean for their lives and their families, and that they can send their kids to school now, and they can build a new house, and they can, you know, reach to their dreams. So we have a team of about 160 commissioned sales staff who are out there doing education, doing marketing, doing sales in the rural areas, demonstrating the pumps. We run major marketing campaigns on the radio. We run campaigns using billboards. We, of course, do promotions. We do pumping competitions on market days. We do a huge amount of different ways of educating these farmers. We work with partners, with other NGOs, with the government, with private sector businesses who are also talking to farmers in order to educate the farmers. And this is what we use our donor funds for, which is educating these very poor farmers about how they can change their lives. And once they're convinced to buy, then they save up the money to buy, they go down to their local shop, and they buy these pumps, and it literally transforms their lives. It does lift them out of poverty. And what we mean by that is that for the first time, they're no longer worried about survival. They're no longer worried about how they're going to feed their kids tomorrow or next week. They're no longer worried about how they're going to spend their kids to school. How are they going to pay for the school fees? How are they going to pay for the basic health care? They're no longer worried about those things. They have enough money for that basic survival. And then, most importantly, they have some money left over to invest in their futures. And so when we think about being out of poverty, it's really that. You're no longer worried about survival, and you have money to invest in your future. And what do? They invest in other businesses. They buy some poultry. They buy some chickens, start keeping it and selling eggs. They maybe buy a couple of cows and start selling milk. They rent more land so they can expand their irrigated area. They build new houses. They send their kids to secondary school or off to college and invest in their futures. So really what we're doing is giving them that first major step out of poverty. And once they've taken that first big step out of poverty, that kickstart, then they continue to make other investments and continue to climb further out of poverty over time. And we very carefully look at and measure these impacts with a very carefully designed impact monitoring program.
My next question was, does Kickstart have patents on their irrigation pumps?
Yes, we do patent the pumps. Although patents are very difficult to protect in places like Africa or India or China where we would be selling pumps, we believe that it's important to patent the pumps primarily so that when you first introduce a technology, a brand new technology, you have to introduce a technology that works really well. Because if you introduce a new product and it doesn't work well, you can absolutely kill that type of product for many, many years. And just a good example of that would be something that we all know well, the iPad. Now, many of us who are old enough would remember something called the Newton. And the Newton was designed by Steve Jobs and introduced by Apple about 30 years ago. And unfortunately, the Newton was a bit of a failure. It was a big disappointment on the market. People didn't think it worked well. They didn't like it. It was withdrawn very quickly, and it literally killed the market for any kind of tablet for almost 30 years. Anybody who produced a tablet would be a running joke, oh, it's another Newton. And it wasn't until Steve Jobs himself came back 30 years later with the iPad, actually a whole generation later if we think about it, where he himself could introduce the iPad and say, no, a tablet is the right solution and it's going to work and it's not another Newton. So in the beginning when you introduce a brand new technology, you really have to be selling the Mercedes. It has to work really, really well. And so we design our products so they are like that. And the reason we patent them is we don't want people to be making bad knockoffs that don't work well and now can kill the market. So we want to have a way to stop people from producing pumps that don't work well. And in the long term, what we want to do is we want to make our pumps, and actually not our pumps, but human-powered irrigation pumps and other low-cost irrigation technologies widely known and widely available across Africa so that every small-scale farmer, when they first start farming, they know, oh, I could make a lot more money if I could irrigate. And I could buy a human-powered irrigation pump. I could maybe, as we go forward, buy a solar pump. I could buy a pump and start irrigating, and this could enable me to make a lot more money. We want to get our pumps to that kind of state where they're that well-known and that well-understood by the average farmer, just like a bicycle is in Africa. There's no farmer in Africa who doesn't know what a bicycle is. They all grow up knowing what a bicycle is, and they know that if they want one, they can buy one in the local shop. You don't have to educate them about the power of a bicycle. So we want to take our pumps to that level. And in order to do that, initially we have to build the market demand, and that's what we're using the donor funds for, to build the education and the market demand. But eventually, it'll take off by word of mouth, and everybody will know about these pumps. And then, of course, competition will come in. And at that point, we don't need to necessarily protect our patents because we want competition to be there. We want choices to be there. We want to create a whole new industry where farmers now have a choice of different pumps. Just as has happened, of course, with iPad. You know, now there's many, many other options we can buy. And that's actually good for the customer. So that's what we're trying to create in Africa with irrigation technologies for very poor farmers. And that's why we use the donor funds to build that market demand, to do that awareness creation, to do that training and that education, so that farmers now want and can demand and get low-cost irrigation technologies.
Thank you so much for joining us today on Modern Tech News on KZSU Stanford 90.1 FM. Our first PSA today is about Children's Health Fund. Co-founded by singer-songwriter Paul Simon, Children's Health Fund is committed to providing health care to the nation's most medically underserved children. The organization supports a national network of pediatric programs in some of our most disadvantaged rural and urban communities and advocates for ensured access to medical care for all children. If you'd like to get involved or make a donation, go to www.childrenshealthfund.org. Our guest today is Dr. Martin Fisher, co-founder and CEO of Kickstart, a nonprofit organization that specializes in irrigation technology. In the next part of the interview, Dr. Fisher will tell us how many people did Kickstart lift out of poverty in Africa. He will also describe where poor African farmers live and what kind of crops they usually grow.
Yeah, so the right number is about 140,000 families who've been lifted out of poverty, which is almost 700,000 people with five people per family. Typically, a farmer in East Africa doesn't live in a village. They live on their farm. They're generally homesteaders, very much like we were in America. And so you get to the end of the tarmac road, the paved road, you get to the end of the dirt road, and then you walk on a dirt track, and eventually you get to where their farm is. The typical size of these farms is 2 or 3 acres. A lucky farmer might own as much as 10 acres, but many of these smallholder farmers today will own as little as a quarter acre or half an acre, and that is where they're trying to grow their crops and survive. And they typically will have a small house on their plot, which would be, if they're still quite poor, it would be made from mud and wattle, so sticks and mud packed on it. It would have a lightweight corrugated iron roof. It used to have thatch roofs, but now thatch is more expensive than corrugated iron. And once they have a little bit more money, they'll replace the mud and wattle walls with concrete blocks or with stone and build a slightly nicer house. And they'll be typically farming on these farms using only two tools, a handheld hoe and a machete. And these are the most commonly used tools across Africa by farmers. And they till the land with these tools. They use the machete to plant their seeds. In East Africa, the most common crops they grow would be maize, which is corn, but it would be a corn that you can make into flour. It's not a sweet corn like we think of corn. It's a dry corn, more like Indian corn. And then they pound that into a flour or grind it into a flour and make a maize meal. And they also will grow potatoes. They'll grow other staple crops, cassava. And then if they have some extra space, they'll grow a few vegetables. Usually it would be some kales, maybe some onions or some tomatoes. And usually, like I said, they all wait for the rain and they all plant those at the same time. And those are the crops that now, 3 to 6 months later, they harvest, and most of them go bad before they can sell them or eat them because everybody else has them.
Next, Dr. Martin Fisher will give us two examples of African families who have used the Kickstart pumps to change their lives and get out of poverty. Here is the first example.
A typical story would be a young couple, Felix and Lucy Muiruri. And they actually live about 50, 60 miles north of the big capital city in Kenya called Nairobi. So they live in a rural area, a fairly crowded rural area. And they actually don't own any land. And the reason being is that their parents owned very small plots, about 1 acre, 2 acres each. And their parents are farming those plots, so they can't give a plot to their children. And so this young couple had 3 young kids. And they were actually living on her father's plot, and her father lived on 1 1/4 acres. And so the young man needed to make money, and so he left home and he went to the big city, and he eventually got a job in the slums, and he was working in an informal sector restaurant where he was making just over $1 a day. And on that dollar a day, he had to rent a small shack in the slum where he could sleep and then try to send whatever money was left over after he slept there and fed himself home to his wife and three kids. And this is a very typical story in Africa. And this is why very often you go to the rural areas and the farms and you only find the woman and the kids, because the man is off in the city trying to make some money. Now, Felix saw one of our low-cost hip pumps and he thought, wow, if I could get that pump, I could really change my life. And he started saving up literally pennies a day, 10 cents a day. And then he also talked to his family and managed to get a small loan from his family. And he came back from the rural area and he bought one of these pumps. And then he rented six little plots of land that between them made up 1 acre. And he rented them from his neighbors in the dry season when they weren't using them. And he and his wife started planting on this land, and they were growing kales, and they were growing French beans, and they were growing tomatoes. We visited them just over 3.5 months later, and they just sold their first harvest. And they had made $1,100 profit from that first harvest. And in addition to that, Felix and Lucy had rented their pump out to a neighbor for $1 a day. So they'd made another $50 or so from renting out the pump to a neighbor. And today, a number of years later, I actually sent my finance team out to the field. And one of the farmers they visited were Felix and Lucy. And on that particular day, they went and they counted the number of tomatoes they had in the field. And those tomatoes on that day were worth $6,500. And on top of that, they had French beans in the field. They've now bought their own land. They have built a house. They employ during harvesting some 10 people. They employ 3 or 4 people on a regular basis. They have bought a petrol pump, but they still use our pump when they can't get petrol and use our pump on the expanded acreage that they have. Absolutely transformed their lives.
And now we listen to the second example of an African family that managed to get out of poverty by using Kickstart's handheld irrigation pump.
I met a woman when I was last in Kenya a couple times ago, and she was telling us she was actually widowed and left with two teenage kids, and she lived on 2 acres of land. And she had no income because she'd been relying on her husband for income. And she went to her father-in-law and said, wow, what can you do to help me? And he said, hey, I'm a poor farmer too. I can't do much. But I will try to help you to buy one of these pumps. And he did. He helped her to buy a Super Money Maker pump, a bigger pump. And she was telling us a story, and this was 8 years earlier. And she said, so when I first got the pump, I kept the kids at home, and they worked the pump, and we started irrigating the land. We dug a shallow well and started irrigating the land. But then very quickly realized I could send the kids back to school, and I can employ some labor instead. And after a couple of years, I'd made enough money to buy some chickens, and I set up a little poultry and started selling eggs as well. And then I made some more money, and I bought a couple of cows, dairy cows, and actually set up a little dairy. And then after 4 years, I had enough money, and I bought a petrol pump, and I also rented some extra land. And now I run this very successful farm. And she told us, today, my daughter is in university in Denmark. My son is in a top private school in Nairobi, and all of their school fees and all of their expenses are paid for from this farm.
Thank you for joining us today for a show about how simple technologies can change the world. One of the developers of these technologies is Dr. Martin Fisher, who co-founded Kickstart, a nonprofit organization that works in Africa. Next, Dr. Martin Fisher will describe his vision of how Africa can develop its agricultural resources and how innovation can help African farmers get out of poverty.
What we're trying to do is create an entrepreneurial middle class in Africa, and that has to be entrepreneurial farmers. If we think about the history of America, if we think about the history of Europe or the history of Japan or even more recently the history of Korea, in every case, development started with successful small-scale farmers who had a successful family farm, and from that family farm, they made enough money that they could now properly educate their children, send their children off to, once they were educated, to start other businesses and to get jobs in the cities. But absolutely, development has to start in Africa from the successful family farm. And right now, the vast majority of farmers in Africa are not successful. They're really just scratching out a living and struggling to stay alive. But with irrigation, we can turn that around. These farmers can turn their farms into really successful businesses where they can make a lot of money. And like I said, the potential is huge because only 4% of the farm's land is irrigated. So the potential is absolutely huge for millions of farmers, probably something like 15 million farmers across Africa who could irrigate and make a whole lot more money for their families. And by building this entrepreneurial middle class, this is ultimately the solution for developing Africa. And it's going to start on the farms, and irrigation is by far the best thing the farmer can do to get ahead.
Now it's time for our second PSA. On Saturday afternoon, December 15th at 5 p.m., the Silicon Valley Boy Choir presents a concert of folk songs, Christmas carols, and music of Aaron Copland and Randall Thompson at the First Baptist Church of Palo Alto. For tickets or information, please call 650-424-1242. That's 650-424-1242 for this December 15th concert of holiday music by the Silicon Valley Boy Choir. My next question was, how can people get in touch with Kickstart?
So we have our website, which is www.kickstart.org, Kickstart one word. And on that we have an email address, it's info@kickstart.org, so that's a general information email we have. We have a small office in San Francisco and a slightly larger office in New York City, but really what we do in the States is fundraise. The vast majority of our people, and we have overall about 250 staff, are in Africa, and our headquarters in Africa is in Nairobi, and that's where we do our technology development, that's where we have our strategic marketing, that's where we develop all our new innovations, and then we have operating programs on the ground in Kenya and in Tanzania in East Africa, and then in Mali and Burkina Faso in West Africa. And in those places, we do all the promotion and education and retail sales that I've been describing. We also have, in 12 other countries across Africa, wholesale shops which sell our pumps in those countries. And in addition, we sell our pumps to all the big nonprofits, so World Vision, Save the Children, FAO, WFP, all the big organizations who work in Africa with small-scale farmers. They buy our pumps and use them in their programs as well.
Next, our guest, Dr. Martin Fisher, will describe Kickstart's ambitious future plans in which they will try to sell four times as many irrigation pumps per year in Africa.
As we're now looking for the future, we're selling, I think I mentioned earlier, about 28,000 pumps per year right now. And we have an ambitious plan to scale that up to over about 120,000 pumps a year. So we want a 4X. Four times the number of pumps we sell per year. When we're selling 120,000 pumps a year, we're literally lifting 100,000 families out of poverty, 500,000 people out of poverty every year, and starting at that scale to really start put a real significant dent in poverty in Africa. And so we have an ambitious plan to scale up over the next 5 to 6 years. And this year, we're really concentrating on the innovations which can drive down the cost of sales, drive up the word-of-mouth sales between customer to customer, from one farmer to another, and really dramatically increase the awareness of our pumps and the sales of our pumps in the countries where we work. You know, we're looking for money to scale up. We're trying to four times our impact, and in order to do that, we want about 2.5 times as much money per year that we need to bring in from donors in order to do all this education and expansion. So we're ambitious in our plans, and of course we need the support from donors and supporters to make that possible. But the real message is that we absolutely can transform poverty in Africa. We can do this by enabling the millions and millions of small-scale farmers to make a lot more money, and the best way to do that is helping them to irrigate their farm through technologies like ours, where they can start growing high-value crops and growing them throughout the year and selling them, especially in the dry season when the price is very high.
My next question was, how does Kickstart plan to achieve its future goal of selling four times as many irrigation pumps in Africa per year?
As I described before, we use donor funds in order to do the education, in order to do the marketing, in order to teach farmers about the power of irrigation. The word of mouth is unfortunately much slower from one farmer to another than we expected or that we hoped for. And the reason for this is if you live in a very poor community and everybody else in the community is also very poor and you make a lot of money, you generally don't want to talk about it too much. And you don't often even want to talk about it to your family, because if you do, you have to look after your whole family and they'll come to you and ask, well, can you pay my school fees? Can you send food? Can you send money? Because they know you have money. And this is especially true in the communities where we work. Some people sometimes call this African socialism, and it's a great thing where you look after your extended family. On the other hand, it means that if you do make money, you generally don't want to talk too much about it. And you don't want to talk to your family, you don't want to talk to your neighbors. And so the word of mouth about the pump sales, the word of mouth about the impact of the pumps is much slower than we expected. So we actually have to find ways to create that word of mouth to encourage people to talk about the pumps. And to do this, we have to get out into the rural areas. What we do is we do a lot of live demonstrations because people need to see the pumps in action to believe them. They can't just see a video or can't just hear about it on the radio. Of course, they don't have TVs, so even a video, you'd actually have to show them on a device. But they actually have to see it, so you have to get out there and do these demonstrations. So what we're going to do now is we're going to be targeting informal farmer groups that typically get together about once a month, and we're going to be training those groups about irrigation, training them about how much money they can make with the pump and about how to do really good farming with irrigation, and then convincing the early adopters to buy a pump in the group and then appointing them to be champions for the pump. And so they will now talk to the other group members about their progress and how much money they've made. And we try to get to a local tipping point within that group, so then maybe all 20 farmers in the group or 30 farmers in the group will buy pumps. And so to encourage word of mouth that way. We also want to greatly increase the impact for any particular farmer who buys a pump by teaching them more what we're calling the agropreneurship, teaching them about the business side and about the farming side of using a pump, and so that the early adopters will be more successful. We're also introducing what we call farmer-friendly financing mechanism. Typically, farmers in rural Africa don't have any access to finance. We all have heard about microfinance, and that works very well in urban areas and peri-urban areas. But it doesn't work very well in rural Africa because the cost of bringing the farmers together and reaching the farmers to collect the money is simply too high for most microfinance organizations. But now that we're meeting with these groups and bringing these groups together to sell them pumps, this will give us an option to offer a rent-to-own model where a farmer could now start renting a pump and make regular payments until they've got their first harvest and then pay for a pump. We also have developed a cell phone layaway program where farmers can actually use their cell phones to actually transfer money into a layaway account to make micro savings for a pump. So we've introduced that, and that also means that once the farmer decides they want to buy a pump, it's easier for them to now make that decision to actually and be able to save the money to buy. So these and many, many other innovations that we're developing and putting in place in order to greatly accelerate the sales. And also a lot of new partnerships, really working with the other NGOs, with the government, with the private sector, because we can't do it alone. We have to partner in order to spread these pumps and get to the point where we're selling that 120,000 a year.
Before we leave our guest, Dr. Martin Fisher, who is an inventor and a social entrepreneur, I asked him to describe a typical working day for him at Kickstart.
The typical day in my life has changed dramatically since I started Kickstart. In the beginning, I was the engineer. And a typical day was going out to the fields, talking to the farmers, going to the workshop, doing the design work on the pump, developing prototypes, testing prototypes, finalizing designs, working with manufacturers, training manufacturers, and getting the high-quality production up, and then looking into the marketing. So I used to be very, very hands-on involved with all of that for many years. And I lived in Kenya for almost 17, almost 18 years, and we started Kickstart in 1991. And I left to come back to the States in about 2002. And the reason I came back to the States was really to fundraise so that we could expand what we were doing and we could scale it up. And so now I spend a lot of the time fundraising and talking to donors and talking at universities and lecturing and finding supporters to help us scale up what we're doing. And I always say it's a very interesting life because I really do marketing and sales to two different audiences. One is to the very, very poorest people in the world, who are the poor rural farmers in Africa, where we're trying to sell them our pumps and educate them about pumps. And the other is when I educate wealthy people here in America about what can be done to really transform and start to eradicate poverty in Africa. And so in both cases, it's a matter of educating. Of course, two very different audiences that you were educating. So it's a very interesting life as a result. And I do spend a lot of time traveling. I go to Africa 3-4 times a year. Of course, we have a team on the ground there. We have a chief operating officer there. We have our engineering team there, our marketing team there. And then I spend time between San Francisco and New York and all around the world, in fact, talking to potential supporters and supporters.
My last question to Dr. Martin Fisher was, how do they choose the African countries that Kickstart works in?
In the beginning, we chose Kenya because I ended up in Kenya, and that's where we started. The reason we went to Tanzania is because many people told us Kenya's easy. It's a wealthier country. It's an entrepreneurial country. Just because you can do this in Kenya doesn't mean it will work anywhere else. Tanzania is right next to Kenya. It's a much poorer country. It's a country that had a socialist background as opposed to a very capitalistic background in Kenya. It's known to be much less entrepreneurial. And so we thought, let's see if we can do it in Tanzania. And so we went across the border, and we've discovered that the farmers in Tanzania are just as hungry to get ahead, just as hungry to make money as the farmers are in Kenya. So it's also working well in Tanzania. And then we went to West Africa, and that was a little bit more opportunistic. There was an opportunity with USAID, who were putting up money for developing agriculture in Mali. And we went and bid on with a group of other organizations. We put in a bid for this very large USAID grant, and we were lucky enough to get it. And so we went up and set a program in Mali. Now, Mali is very different. It's in West Africa. It's predominantly Muslim as opposed to predominantly Christian culture. It's a more village-based culture than East Africa is. It's an even poorer place, even than Tanzania. And so somewhat different challenges, but we've also had success selling our pumps in Mali. And then from there, we went to Burkina Faso, which is next to it. We very recently just got a grant to set up a new program in Zambia, down in southern Africa. Zambia is a place with high potential for what we do. There's a very good water source, groundwater resources. There's big demand for vegetables and fruits in the dry season because they presently import a lot from South Africa and other places. And there's a lot of smallholder farmers down there. And also from Zambia, we can now reach into Mozambique. We can reach into Malawi. We can reach into the Democratic Republic of Congo. And there's a lot of other countries where there's a very big market for our pumps from Zambia. So a little bit opportunistic and a little bit looking at places where we have the best potential for real impacts, where we have at least peaceful governments. It's very hard to go into a place which is at war, of course, or has a broken down government like Somalia, and places where we know there's a lot of small-scale farmers who can benefit from irrigation.
Thank you so much for joining us today on Modern Tech News on KZSU Stanford 90.1 FM. Our guest today was Dr. Martin Fisher, CEO and co-founder of Kickstart. Kickstart is a nonprofit organization that has helped lift approximately 750,000 people out of poverty. It has been a great honor and privilege to interview Dr. Fisher. If you would like a copy of today's interview, please visit our website, moderntechnews.com. That's moderntechnews.com.